So we're beginning a series today called Villains that I have honestly been excited for 6 months. Like sometime at the end of 2020, I came up with this idea of talking about the worst characters in the Bible. And the reason I'm so excited about that is because we're in a season that Christians around the world called Lent. Now, Lent, for some of you, when you hear the word Lent, you think of that's something that Catholics do, and Taco Bueno starts selling these weird burritos around this time of year. But Lent is actually something that it's not just a Catholic thing. Christians of all different kinds and around the world honor Lent because it's the weeks leading up to Easter. And it's such a special time to me because I've realized how much the world needs a group of people to do this. Because Lent is a time that Christians around the world look in the mirror and ask ourselves, where is the brokenness that is so easy for me to see in the world and other people? Where is it at in me? Because I don't know about you, but this does not come naturally to me. I mean, we just went through a season that was so divisive in politics. And by the way, that billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars are being pumped in to make us think the things that we think about politics. But we've just gone through a season where all the things that are wrong in the world are with other people, or we blame the politicians, or we blame closer to home, we blame our spouses, we blame our kids, or we blame our jobs, or our friends. But tell me if those things don't have one thing in common. Because you voted for them. You married them. You raised them. You chose those friends. You took that job. And so Lent is a time of year where we look honestly in the mirror and we ask, what's wrong with what I see? It takes a rare act of courage in the world we live in today to take responsibility for our own actions. And so we're doing a series where we look at the worst characters in the Bible, and I want you to see they're not monsters. In fact, they're very relatable. That's one of the great things about the Bible. So there's this British missionary who decades ago, a guy named Leslie Newbegin. He went to India, and when he first got there, he gave someone he was trying to tell the story of Jesus to a Bible. And a few months later, the person brought the Bible back and said, "This is not a religious book. This book is it hardly mentions the gods. It's filled with ordinary people, often very bad people." And here's one of the things I want, the reason I like that story so much is because if you grew up familiar with church stuff, you tend to think this is normal. This is not a normal religious book. The Bible is unflinchingly honest about the fact that we're not that great. It's super honest about the human condition, and it's especially honest about how we got to where we are. It's especially honest about the beginning of bad. So if you have your Bible, turn it to the book of Genesis. Think about the way the story starts off. In Genesis 3, right after God makes the first human couple, he puts them in a garden, and there's this serpent that comes in. And the Bible, Genesis does not try to explain where the serpent comes from, but the serpent tries to talk Adam and Eve, the first human couple, into disobeying God. God has given them a choice, and the serpent is trying to get them to exercise that choice against God. And as soon as they do, the first emotion they feel is shame and fear. And even though they're new at this emotion, they act like pros at using it. Because as soon as God comes to check on them, they are aware that something is wrong. And God, the first conversation after bad has entered the world, this is what happens. God's like, "Hey, did you guys eat the fruit that I told you not to?" And Adam's first words to God is, the woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit and I ate it." And if you read between the lines, he's saying, not only is he blaming Eve, he's blaming who else? God, yeah, the woman you gave me. God, it was fine when it was just me and you, right? Remember the good old days? And then you had this crazy idea about making somebody else. So how about this? How about you and Eve? You guys go off and you do what you got to do to her, but leave me out of it. And this is how God goes and talks to Eve, and she blames the serpent. Yeah, even though they're new at this, they are pros at it. They are just immediately blaming each other. And the rest of history is basically one sad commentary of them doing exactly that. It doesn't take long before the very next chapter, their kids, one of their sons raises up and kills his brother. And we go to like a war zone in just a chapter. And the rest of Genesis is this soap opera. Basically, of other people, everybody blaming other people. Some people are loved too much. Some people are not loved enough. Some people are hairy. Some people are not hairy enough. And they're all blamers. How many of us are blamers here? I know it's a weird question to ask because you don't normally want to take responsibility if you're a blamer. So how many of y'all know Brené Brown, the sociologist Brené Brown? Okay, there was more in first service. Who knew Brené Brown? So Brené Brown is a sociologist. You probably have seen like her TED Talks because, I don't know, like 50 million people have seen them. She's done some great work on vulnerability and fear and things like that. But she did some work on blame. And when she talked about like why blaming is a really hard problem, but she tells a story when she does the work on blame where she talks about how a few years ago she had woken up and she was doing her regular morning routine. She was in the kitchen all by herself, and she was wearing white pants, and she was drinking her second cup of coffee. And as she's drinking the coffee, she, of her own accord, accidentally drops the cup of coffee. It drops, hits the ground, spills and splatters coffee all over her white pants. And her first thought was, "I hope you're happy now, Steve." Steve is her husband. Steve isn't in the kitchen. She's all by herself, but her first thought is, look what you've done. And she says, here's the backstory. The night before, my husband was going to a sporting event, and I told him, hey, I can't go to sleep until you get home, so if you could, please be home by 10. And he didn't get home till 10:30. So she didn't get to sleep at the time she wanted to get to sleep to, ergo the second cup of coffee. And then as soon as the coffee hits the ground, her brain, in a microsecond, made that move, which I love that story because it's so relatable, right? I mean, we are blamers. And then she goes on to say the problem with blaming is that it's actually not helping anybody. The reason we blame, the reason we're so good at blaming is because it makes you feel like you're in control for a second. It gives you some way of handling the pain of the anger of the situation, but it actually hurts your relationship, she says. It destroys your capacity for like empathy and understanding where other people are coming from. And so if that's true, if it makes us worse at relationships, why do so many people blame? Well, it's because we come from a long line of blamers. You might say it's the family tradition. So if you're just to go through the book of Genesis, one at a time, you would find a rich history that sounds really oddly modern of people doing just like this. I mean, think about Cain, the son of Adam and Eve, who kills his brother Abel because God accepts his brother's sacrifice and not his own. And God even warns Cain. God says, listen, sin is crouching at your door. You better watch out. But even that isn't enough. He gets mad. He makes a little plan, and he kills his brother. And then God comes to Cain and asks him, hey, where's your brother at? And you remember what Cain says in response? Am I my brother's keeper? I mean, you can hear the avoidance of blame is right there. In other words, listen, God, if Abel happens to show up dead, then don't come looking for me. I don't know. That kid, he's got all kinds of problems. Like, go look for him yourself. He is not taking responsibility. And God, who is never fooled by our blame game, says to him, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Okay, you don't think you're your brother's keeper. Well, you're your brother's killer. I'm not fooled by your blame game. don't tell me about how much your brother whined or how he was a goody two shoes. Cain, I'm not looking at Abel. I'm looking at you. And your justifications for how bad he was don't hold up. Do you realize that every single one of us are going to have to stand beneath the gaze of God? That our lives are going to be looked at. And that whole way that of self-justification that we are experts at will wither away under the stare of God. So God tells Cain, once Cain finally owns up to reality, God tells Cain, you're going to have to leave. And Cain says, no. It'll be so bad. If people know I've killed someone, they're going to kill me. So God mercifully puts a mark on him to let people know he is under my protection. If anybody messes with Cain, if they murder you, they will have avenged, your blood would be avenged 7 times. But what is the mercy of God is misunderstood as the vengeance of God. Because a generation later, a guy named Lamech says, you know that thing? That idea that God had about 7 times, if anybody messes with me, I will kill them not 7 times, but I'll kill their family and their friends 77 times. Actually, this is what he says. Lamech speaks to himself in third person. We just had Valentine's Day. This sounds so romantic the way he talks to his wives. Adam and Zillah, listen to me. This is Hallmark, I hope you're listening. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech will be avenged 77 times. Lamech's point is, if you come at me with a knife, I'm coming at you with a gun. And I'm not just going to go after you, but I'm going to come after your friends and your family. There's a guy named Joseph Campbell who's done a lot of really good work on stories that human beings have told for the last few thousand years. And I'm talking about all the different kinds of stories, from Homer's Odyssey to Star Wars to Hamlet to Sleeping Beauty, all the different kinds of stories. He's looked at thousands of years and hundreds of thousands of stories, and he basically said there's 7 different stories. So there's 7 different kinds of stories that people tell over and over and over again, from Shakespeare to Star Wars. But what's interesting to me is what those stories have in common. Here's what he said. In every kind of story, whenever there's some kind of pain or something bad that happens, somebody loses their parents at their young age, and that character decides to do something redemptive with that. They lose their parents and they decide that they're going to grow up and help other people who have lost their parents. Whenever they, you know, get a cancer diagnosis and they decide that they're going to try to fight cancer, or they're going to help other people who have the similar diagnosis. Whenever somebody has some kind of pain and they decide to do something redemptive with this, we have a word for that in stories for thousands of years. What's the word? Hero. But whenever someone has something bad happen, has something painful happen, and they decide that they are going to take that as a justification to cause pain to someone else, including for vengeance, you know, their parents died at an early age, so why should your parents live? Their parents died at an early age, so I can do what I want. They had cancer, why are you healthy? Whenever people have pain and they use it as a means to, or a excuse to pass on that pain to other people, we have a word for them too. What's the word? Villains. We tell our kids this in our household all the time. I know nobody thinks of themselves as a villain. That is the human condition. Even villains, especially villains, don't think of themselves as a villain. But maybe a more insightful question we could ask ourselves is, what's our relationship to blame? How hell-bent are you on making sure that you don't take responsibility, or that you get even? And make no mistake about it, that is the bent of hell. So Lamech's way of thinking, his way of thinking, I'm going to get vengeance, it's so pervasive, it catches on. And then in Genesis 6, have your Bibles, because I want you to see this really is in your Bibles. In Genesis 6, in verse 5, look at what God actually says. the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. Every inclination, even the imagination of human beings, was messed up. Now, here's where I think it's important for us to realize, because we live in an increasingly post-religious society. And let me tell you what religion, especially Christianity, because we're becoming more post-Christian, what it feels like to someone who doesn't go to church, didn't grow up in church, or maybe did grow up in church, but is just kind of done with it. One of the biggest critiques that they would have on the outside of Christianity is this. Human beings are kind of good. Like, we're basically kind of good people. And if you think that, if you think that human beings are basically good, then religion seems like an outside force imposing kind of like a problem that doesn't really need to be solved. In my experience, though, this is the great weakness in walking away from faith as a secularist. It's one that takes a lot of naivety and a lot of self-unawareness. Because human beings, in my experience, when push comes to shove, we are very good at putting on veneers of politeness. We are very good at acting nice when everything's going fine. But when push comes to shove, and if you doubt me, you can go to places where push does come to shove. Places like join a prison ministry. Or look at different places where there are limited resources, like vaccines right now. When push comes to shove, human beings are not good to each other. They're not good for each other, and they're not good with each other. Now, yes, every human being is made in the image of God. This is one of the things Genesis is trying to say. Every human being has the dignity that is imbued by them, by God, being made by this creator God. But God, at the end of six chapters of Genesis, looks at us and says, every imagination, every thought was wicked. Now, here's one of the problems in our churches of Christ we've had. We thought that meant like sin behavior. We thought that meant like basically just don't drink, don't, you know, smoke, or don't cuss. But that sin is so much thicker and deeper than that. Every thought. One of the problems we've had in churches of Christ is we thought we could think our way to God. We thought we could reason our way back to the way, you know, it used to be. We thought we could reason our way back to Jesus. And I don't know if you've noticed, but that actually leads to some toxic self-righteous fruit. Because it's not just that, like, the way that we behave is bad. It's even the places we try to be good without the grace of God can lead to some bad stuff. This is not just that we do bad stuff. It's that our minds, our reasoning, our imaginations have been poisoned. And the reason I'm trying to hit this so hard is because the Bible wants us to know, Genesis wants us to know, we are not the precious darlings we thought we were. Genesis does not want you to be surprised when you get to Abraham, Father Abraham, and he tries to pawn off his wife to save his own skin twice. Genesis doesn't want you to be surprised when you get to Jacob, the guy who's named Israel, like the Israel, and Jacob's like a jerk. Jacob like lies and cheats, and here's what Genesis wants you to know. Even our heroes aren't heroes. Even our saints aren't saintly. I mean, there's right now, if you're caught up on the news in the evangelical world, like Ravi Zacharias, you're aware, like, oh man, I can't believe that. Well, Genesis, like, you should have known. If you paid attention throughout history, with, you know, stuff like Karl Barth, the great thinker, and the kind of side, C.S. Lewis and the problems that he had, Genesis is like, you should have known. Even our heroes aren't heroic. Even our saints aren't saintly, but there's always hope because God is always at work, even in the cracks in our midst, maybe especially through that. It is hard to pick my favorite villain in Genesis, but I think today it's Judah. Now, For those of you who are familiar with Judah, you're like, well, first off, you named a son after Judah, Jonathan. But I really think Judah's the best villain in Genesis. Because Judah, now I know he seems heroic, but not at first. Judah comes from a long line of blamers. And when we first meet Judah, he is living up to the family tradition. So his dad's name is Jacob. Jacob has 12 kids, and his favorite is a son named Joseph. We know this because Dolly Parton sang about it. He gave Joseph a multicolored coat. The brothers, the other 11 brothers, they hate this. They decide they're going to kill Joseph. So they put him in a pit. They're waiting on him to die. And then a caravan of Ishmaelites come along, and they're like, why kill our brother when we could get some money for him? So they sell their brother into slavery. He winds up being a slave and then being falsely accused, going into prison, and then through a fortunate turn of events, he actually is going to become the vice president of Egypt, the Kamala Harris of Egypt, and he's going to become like this really big deal who's going to save the world in a time of famine. But I don't want to get to that part of the story yet, because Genesis doesn't. Genesis takes this kind of odd detour after you find out that Joseph is like delivered from slavery in prison and goes back to Judah, one of Joseph's brothers. And it tells you about Judah's family, because Judah's got three sons. One, the firstborn, is a guy named and marries a woman named Tamar. Now, and Tamar are doing fine, but dies before Tamar and him have a child. So back in that day, they had this custom where if a brother died, his other brother, if a brother died and did not have an heir or a descendant, his other brother would step in and father a child, and that child would not be considered the biological dad's son or daughter. It would be considered his deceased brother's son or daughter. And so the man who died, his brother Onan, is by custom required to step in and help Tamar father a child that would be considered Onan's dead brother's child. Is that confusing enough? All right, so that's what happens. Onan steps in. He sleeps with Tamar. They're going to have a child. But let me just say it this way. Onan fulfills the letter of the law and not the spirit of the law, and that's, I'll leave it at that. And God sees what he did. Onan does not want to give Tamar a child because it'll cut down the inheritance. That would be seen as the firstborn descendant. And he knows that's not good for my net worth. So Onan's trying to like cut a corner here, and he refuses to live up to his obligation, and God strikes Onan dead. So now Tamar goes back to Judah, the dad of these three sons, and says, hey, it didn't work out with it didn't work out with Onan, but you've got this other son. And Judah's like, you know what? I'm noticing a pattern here. 66% of my children have been married to you, and they are dead now. So he's starting to think like Tamar is the original man-eater. So he says, you know what, let the other son, let him just have like his childhood. Let him, you know, grow up a little bit. And then when he's ready, we can talk. So Tamar takes him at his word. And then after some time goes by, she realizes that was a mistake. That Judah is just slow pedaling. He has no intention on letting her have his third son in marriage. And now it's where it gets weird. Some of you are like, it wasn't weird before. And by the way, if you're on the outside listening to this and you don't normally go to church or you don't normally read your Bible, this stuff is fascinating. This is what I mean when I say this is not like your standard religious book. This is in the book that we read together as Christians every week. So Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar, realizes that Judah isn't going to give him another son to have a child. So she dresses up like a prostitute. She goes to where Judah normally hangs out. And she gets her father-in-law to be the father of her child. And when Judah goes to pay her as a prostitute, he's going to work out this deal, or he's going to trade her livestock for her services rendered. And he realizes, I don't have any livestock on me, but I do have my signet ring. So it's like his drive, the driver's license of the day. So he gives it to her and says, this will be held as a pledge until I can get you your payment of goats. And she's like, all right, I'll hold on to this. And then Tamar goes back home, takes off the, you know, outfit she had been wearing, the makeup and the disguise, and everything goes back to normal, except for about 3 months later. All of a sudden, there starts to be a baby bump. And this is why I like Judah so much as a villain, because he's so relatable to me. As somebody who grew up in church, as somebody who can see Judah in the mirror that I look into every day. Because when the word gets back to Judah that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant and she shouldn't have been, you know what he says? Kill her. How dare she? How dare she sleep around? I mean, who does she think she is? This is the woman who was married to my sons. I can't believe. I mean, imagine how indignant he would have been. Imagine how self-righteous he would have been as the community begins to circle around this idea. They're going to have an honor killing. They're going to kill Tamar because she is pregnant and she had no business being pregnant. And as they come to arrest and kill Tamar, she's like, oh, you're right, you got me. I can't hide this. I am pregnant. But before the village leader, you know, Judah, before he has me put to death and, you know, says all the righteous pronouncements about the reason I must be put to death, could you just pass him one little message? Let him know that the dad of this baby, because, you know, it takes two to tango, the dad of this baby is the guy who owns this signet ring. Checkmate. Because when Judah sees that's his signet ring, he realizes what's been going on. Now, I know this story is super confusing to modern readers. You're like, what? What's? I can't believe you're telling this story in the middle of church. But listen, there's a scholar, a woman named Carolyn Custis James, who points it this way. Patriarchal concepts of family honor and duty to her dead husband, that's what drives her. The reason Tamar does this, if we miss this one piece, we'll unjustly reduce her motives to desperate longings for a baby or a chance to get even with Judah, her lying father-in-law. But Tamar's not doing it for that. She's doing it to carry on the legacy of her dead husband, She's taken an enormous chance and actually a huge risk to produce a son for her dead husband. Do you realize what's happening here? This story, it strikes us as odd and a little bit dirty, but she's acting as virtuously as she can in her situation. She's trying to keep her dead husband's honor and legacy still alive, and she's doing just about anything. And that's when this watershed moment happens. And this is what I hope for us. This is what I hope for me in this series, because there's a watershed moment that happens in Judah's life that changes him. When he realizes that not only was she not the villain, but he was the villain. And he was a worse villain than he thought. He says, leave Tamar alone. She's more righteous than I. Can I tell you, I know this about self-righteous people. We cannot say that sentence. If you're self-righteous, it is so hard to be in the same room as somebody who's better at it than you are. And one of the reasons that Judah is such an inspiration to me is because in this moment, he can clearly see in the mirror what we have been able to see all along. And it changes him. He is not the same man after this story. It's weird in the book of Genesis. If you're reading along and all of a sudden, you know, it's the story of Joseph and Joseph is in, it's like this action-packed movie, and then all of a sudden, there's this weird tangent of Judah. Why are you telling us this, Genesis? It's because it has to. Because you're not going to recognize Judah the next time you see him. Because see, what happens is the brothers, they have to go back to Egypt. Because of the famine happens, they go back to Egypt, they're hungry, and they run into Joseph because he's the one who's dealing out the grain and stuff. And they don't recognize him. The last time they saw him, he was, you know, younger and a slave. And now he's the VP of Egypt. They don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And Joseph decides he's going to see, are my brothers still the same? So he's got the rest, 10 of them are half-brothers, and one of them is his full brother, Benjamin. And so Joseph decides he's going to keep Benjamin with him in Egypt. As they go back to send grain to his dad and other people, he's going to keep Benjamin with him, so he pretends to arrest him on false charges. Benjamin and the other brothers don't know he's pretending, but he's pretending to arrest them on false charges. And something happens when he pretends to arrest him, because he's going to, what they think is he's going to make him a slave. Something happens when Joseph goes to arrest Benjamin that nobody saw coming. Judah steps in and says, I'll take his place. If you've got to take somebody into slavery, don't take my brother. Take me. This, up until this point in Genesis, it's all been backstabbing and blaming and competition until this moment. There's a preacher named John Ortberg who says this is actually the first time in human history that we know of that somebody said out loud, I will be the sacrifice for somebody else. This is a new way of being human. This is the first person to show what it looks like to stop being a villain. And strangely enough, it is the first great turn of the Bible. Because Jesus doesn't come through Joseph. King Jesus comes through Judah. And Jesus is the new Adam. Jesus is the true hero who doesn't blame, who doesn't do any of the work of villains, but dies like one anyway. He was the one born into a world broken bad, and he was born to break bad. And you notice what he did when they arrested him? When Jesus is arrested, the one who was so good with words all the time, when they started to blame and accuse him, he didn't do the thing that all of us are so good at doing. He didn't justify himself. He didn't defend himself. Instead, he just silently, he echoed back their accusations to them all night long. The one who could shadow box with words was silent as the blame that was due all of us fell on him, because he is the shining that your shame cannot extinguish. Jesus is the door where you thought there was only wall. He is what comes after deserving. And because of what Jesus did, we can take an honest look in the mirror and know we are loved in spite of what we see. Preacher I like named Tony Campolo talks about growing up in Philadelphia, and one of the defining moments of his life was one day at church. There was a woman who had a bad reputation in the town that he grew up in for a lot of different reasons, but she came to church and she normally didn't. And when it was time to receive communion, this woman let the tray pass her by because she wasn't worthy. And he watched, Tony Campolo watched his dad get up, grab the tray, and take it back to her, and grab her by the woman, by the shoulders, and shake her and say, "This is meant for you. This is meant for especially for you." Do you realize what we do every week when we receive communion? Do you realize that it is the opposite of blame? This is a confession. Because only the sick need a doctor. We are saying we acknowledge we are not the heroes of the story. We are not the people we thought we were. Jesus has done what only Jesus could do. He lived the life that only he could live, because Jesus is the new and better Adam. Jesus is the new and better Judah. And if we'll let him this week and in our lives, in our families, in our neighborhoods, Jesus wants to be the new and better you.